I'm Eva Bolza from Colorado School of Mines. Welcome to another seismology talk. First of all, it's my pleasure to be here, and it's also my first time to be. It's not on? Or maybe I should. Can you hear me now? Is it better? Okay. So it's my pleasure to be here. This is also my first CIDR. We have been discussing about the discrepancies between seismic tomography models. And today I'm going to talk about how can we benefit by simulating wave propagation, taking the full physics into account numerically. So I have some slides and movies from my contributors here. I would like to thank them. And last week, Sana made a brief introduction to ray theory. And Jessica is going to talk about normal modes tomorrow, Thursday. So I'm not going to go into details of computing the forward problem in seismology using ray theoretical and methods and normal modes, but I will make a brief review of ray theory. I will focus on numerical solution of wave propagation. And we talk about inverse problem, linearized inverse problem. You also had a practical session. I will be more focusing on the gradient-based optimizations to show you how we can take into account 3D wave simulations in seismic tomography. And then I will talk about current status in global imaging, and then challenges and future directions in seismic tomography. Okay, so I also have so many slides, I think. Please feel free to interrupt me, or you can also say, please skip this part. Feel free to do that. This is what we basically talked about last week. In seismic tomography, we are trying to interpret Earth's interior in terms of wave speeds, density, anisotropy, or anelasticity using a set of observed data, which is, in our case, seismograms or some secondary observables, such as travel times, phase velocity, or group velocities. And by computing synthetic seismograms using for a given model is the forward problem. And for computational ease, this part has been done based on some approximations like ray theory. And then by looking at the discrepancies between observed and synthetic data, we are trying to interpret a set of model parameters, which is the inverse problem. However, this process has some challenges, as Webb already mentioned. We don't know the true model. We basically don't know how the Earth looks like. We have no chance to go down and see how it looks like. But we have some seismograms. And then we, based on an estimated model, we generate synthetic seismograms. And by looking at the difference between them, we estimate a model of Earth's interior. But then the remaining problem is how well we can estimate the true model. And that's the challenge. But in this case, as we talk about all the discrepancies between models, uncertainty quantification is extremely important. But our goal is, or we are just asking the question, what if we take the full physics into account in the forward simulations, avoiding approximations? How can we contribute to further improve the Earth's models? And my focus is going to be on global tomography. So Sana showed this figure last week, just to show the seismic spectrum of various studies. So this is the period range. This is the frequency band. They are the same. This is just inverse of period. And as Sana mentioned, generally, exploration seismologists prefer to use frequency, and global seismologists prefer to use period. And this is the regime of the exploration seismics. And this is mainly the region we are interested in, the band we are interested in earthquake seismology, and then at longer, much longer periods, we have the crustal deformation. So in my talk, I will mainly be focusing on this range, more or less, considering body waves and surface waves, excluding normal modes. Just a brief review of ray theory and finite frequency theory. So you again did a practical with lead to estimate a phase loss map. That was from Göran Ekström. This is another phase loss map, but it doesn't matter. It's just easier to explain certain things in 2D using surface waves, but whatever I'm going to say is also valid in 3D. So in the great circle, it's very common in the classical tomography to make this great circle approximation, which means basically you can estimate the phase perturbations between a source and a receiver. Assume that you have a source here and a receiver here, and this is your phase loss perturbation map. You can basically estimate the phase by integrating phase loss perturbations along great circle path. I mean, it's a line in 2D, but in 3D, it will be great circle, which is similar to the flight. When you take a plane, you know, it's the shortest distance between two points is the great circle. But in fact, as Kanani also mentioned, that atoms, when they build up, they prefer to spend minimum energy, right? And it's the same for seismic waves. They prefer to follow minimum phase path, or in other words, the fastest route. So then the rays actually are banded around 3D heterogeneities following Fermat's rule. And basically you can integrate perturbations along the exact ray path. In the finite frequency theory, you are basically replacing or this ray integration with a kernel which takes into account first order scattering and then integrated over the sphere, or if in 3D, over the volume. Just what I forgot to mention is that ray theory is a high frequency approximation, and since we are working with band limited data, especially at the current resolution of tomographic images, we have reached the limits of ray theory, and its validity strongly depends on frequency of waves, propagation distance of waves, and smoothness of heterogeneities. But in general, whenever you have a scale length of heterogeneity comparable to the wavelength of your waves, then ray theory is likely to break down, where the finite frequency effects become important. Excuse me? This is the kernel. This is a kernel which takes into account all these first order scatterings over a Fresnel zone. The question was what the K here is. I'm not going to go into the details of ray theory, but just wanted to show this slide to also convince you that you can also estimate the amplitudes. And what I would like to point out here is that most of the tomographic models are based on phase measurements. However, if you can use the amplitudes, you have valuable, very invaluable information, just because phase perturbations are sensitive to the second spatial derivative in amplitude. So if you can use amplitudes in seismic tomography, basically you can localize heterogeneities much better. But it's a much more complex problem. So for ease of or to simplify the problem, we generally prefer to start with phase. So I stole this figure from Heiner Riegel, actually. He replotted it after Akira and Richards, which shows the phase space of scattering. Basically, gives an idea. It's a very nice illustration where we are in imaging. So here, K is the wave number. Lambda is the wavelength of your waves. And this is the relation between wave speed and wavelength and frequency. A is the dominant wavelength of the heterogeneous medium. So wave number times A gives you a correlation length, basically shows you, it's a kind of metric, how the scattering regime changes. So this is the propagation distance. This is K, and L is the propagation distance. So basically what it tells us that if K times A is much bigger than 1, which means if the scale length of your heterogeneity in your medium is way too large, it's more or less like you're in a homogeneous media. So you can use anything you like, okay? In the wave theoretical approximation, we said that your scale length of heterogeneity should be much longer than your wavelength. And this is the wave theoretical regime, basically, when A is much bigger than lambda. And this is where we are in the computational or with the numerical methods, where basically when the A becomes comparable to the wavelength of your waves, then basically you're in the scattering regime, strongly scattering regime. And if A is too small, or if you are looking at very long propagation distances, you're in a highly scattered regime. Perhaps this is what Nick would be interested in. This is where Nick is working. And if A is very small than your wavelength, then basically, again, maybe you can replace that model with a Nick-equivalent homogeneous one. It's this regime. So this figure is from 1980s, but still pretty good at explaining the current status, because basically, if you would like to go down, I mean, this is kind of the regime, the current resolution for us with the numerical methods in global simulations. We are pushing down the simulations down to 1 hertz globally, but still we haven't achieved it because this is a highly scattered regime, and also which makes the simulations extremely expensive. So there are lots of community codes. This is from CIG's website, the list of all seismology codes. So there are some, I mean, most of them are wave propagation codes, except, well, Berman is also not, Berman is also kind of wave propagation, but it has a different philosophy. Flaxman is a phase selection algorithm. The others are SPECFAM 3D Globe, SPECFAM 3D Cartesian, AXISM, SPECFAM 3D Geotech, SW4, and Seismic CPML. They are finite difference methods. There is also 2D version of SPECFAM and 1D version of SPECFAM, and there is MINIOS, which is the normal mode. So the message I would like to give you is that nowadays, you know, we have access to all these beautiful codes. And I'm a spoiled user of SPECFAM. That's why my talk will be a bit biased towards SPECFAM, but that doesn't mean that the other codes are any worse. This is the message I would like to give you. But whenever you use such a community code, there are certain things that you must be careful. Of course, you cannot know every details, but you should also not be using them like a black box. So I would like to talk a bit of about this. And this is a very good reference book, a recent book by Heine Riegel on computational seismology. So if you have any interest, I will strongly suggest this book, which also has nice practicals, which you can directly work on Jupyter notebooks. So I'm going to first formalize forward problem in seismology. And then there are various numerical methods, but I will be only focusing on finite difference and spectral elements, and then give you a bit of tips how you should be using these black boxes. So this is the equation of motion, what we are interested in to solve. So basically, S is the displacement, the second time derivative of displacement, which is acceleration. This is density, and this is the stress tensor. And this is the source term. And in our case, it's an earthquake source, which is given by a moment tensor at a location. and defined by a source time function st. We have already seen Hooke's law in Sana's talk. Stress tensor is related to strain tensor through a fourth order elastic tensor. And we have to set up our boundary and initial conditions, and at the scale of globe, our boundary condition is the free surface where the traction is vanishing. And the initial conditions is that at time t0, there is no displacement. And the velocity is also zero. So for convenience, we like to, I mean, we can directly attack to solve this problem, but we like to reformulate it in the strong form, which means that when you are working with the partial derivatives, we like to reformulate this problem in terms of velocity stress formulation. Just this is in 3D. Just to make it more clear, I rewrote it for 1D wave equation in a homogeneous medium. So you can rewrite this in terms of acceleration and the second derivative in space of the displacement. And here alpha is the P wave speed, but in case of S wave speed, it will be beta. And this is the elastic moduli, how P, for P and S wave for an isotropic medium, they vary. And then we can directly attack to solve this. All we need to do is just compute these second order derivatives in time and in space, numerically, right? However, it's much more desirable if we deal with first order derivatives. That's why we just reformulated in terms of velocity and stress. Then we have two equations where we have only first order derivatives with respect to time and with respect to space, using these relations where velocity is the first time derivative of displacement and stress tensor is related to the spatial derivatives of the displacement. But then, now we are in a discretized Earth, okay? So you should just know that this is no longer your model. You have to sample your model one way or another. And then eventually, this is what you are going to see. So it's up to you how well you are going to capture all the complexity in your domain by discretizing your model. It's your job, basically. But you have to discretize both in space and then in time to march to get the results of the numerical solutions. So in the case of finite difference, this is also going to let us know the accuracy of numerical simulations. This is the first thing that you need to be careful. If you just expand a function, the value of function at x plus delta x, or backward x minus delta x, and expand it into Taylor series, this is what we have. So remember our problem, where we are trying to obtain the first time and spatial derivatives of velocity and stress. Basically, this is what we are trying to extract. So if we ignore all these higher order terms, in the forward difference sense, this is how we can estimate the derivatives. Both, we can apply this both to spatial and the time derivatives, and this is the error term, depending on where you truncate the Taylor series. And this is going to give you the accuracy of your numerical simulations. In other words, if you have access to an analytic solution, how well you can estimate the analytic solution. But this is directly going to be governed by the length of your Taylor series. And this is just an illustration what happens to increase the accuracy. Of course, you can keep higher order terms, and this is just an illustration of this, but you can see that after second or third order terms, the effect of higher order terms vanish very quickly. This is another thing that you have to be careful, the stability of your solutions. So basically, you can test the stability of your algorithm. For instance, in case of using central difference, both in spatial and time derivatives, you can just use a harmonic wave and then try to solve it, and then you come up with such an expression. And this expression is going to be stable only if this term equals or small than 1. And this condition is known as Coulomb-Friedrich Levy criterion, or simply Coulomb condition. So where delta t and delta x are the sampling rate in time and sampling rate in space. So this directly tells you that you have to be careful when you are discretizing your medium and in your problem in time. Otherwise, as you run your simulations in time, your solution may blow up if you do not satisfy this condition. That's the second thing you need to be careful. Dispersion of seismic waves is a well-known phenomenon, so which is very useful. For instance, here you are looking at a law wave package, an unfiltered law wave, and we can represent it if we take the Fourier transform of this, or filtered with bandpass, bandpass filters at different periods, from short to longer periods. It tells you that basically wave speeds of these law waves can be frequency dependent. As you see, when you decompose this law wave into its harmonics, at longer periods, waves arrive earlier. Do you know why is that? Any idea? That's just because wave speed increases by that in general. That's why longer periods, they sample deeper parts, and they arrive earlier, but shorter periods, they arrive later. So wave speeds are frequency dependent. And this is a very nice property, because then we can obtain these beautiful phase velocity curves, and then phase velocity maps, and then we can interpret Earth's interior. This is something desirable. However, if you are not careful enough when you are discretizing your model, when you are going to run these wave simulations, this is what you are going to get. This is a law wave computed for a layer over a homogeneous half space. It's also dispersive, as you see. And this is a law wave on a purely homogeneous medium, where you shouldn't observe any dispersion. However, you see a strong dispersion, which is just coming from inappropriate sampling of your medium, both in space and time. So basically, depending on how you are discretizing your model, you may have some numerical dispersion, which you may, yeah.
I thought it'd be very helpful to explain what that one on the right would look like in an ideal situation. Is it a delta function, or is it original? You know, what should it look like without the?
It will depend on your source time function. If you just send an impulse, like let's say a Gaussian impulse, it should just continue in a homogeneous isotropic model. It should just continue as it is.
So that one was a Gaussian, and now it's.
Let's say, I don't know the how it was initiated, but something like Gaussian or a Ricker wavelet, or generally the derivative of Gaussian is used as a source time function. So you must not see all this dispersive behavior. Your original source time function should just continue propagating as it is, because there is no distortion, if you can set up your problem properly. So this is kind of the criteria criterion for this. And so this plot just shows that you basically, for different Coulomb conditions, this is the number of grid points per wavelength that is needed to properly simulate this, and where the true phase velocity is 2,000 meters per second in this case. So as you see, depending if you have less number of grid points, you are likely going to have this physical numerical dispersion, which is artificial. again, if we come back to our equation of motion, so this was a strong form, but we can also reformulate this in an integral form. So weak form doesn't mean that it's weak or worse than strong methods. Weak form, it just means that it's an integral form. So basically, what is being done here is that we are just taking the dot product of this with a test vector omega and integrated over a volume, where, and then the same here, we just take the dot product with the test vector, again integrating over the volume. And this is the source term, again, dot, having the dot product with the test vector. So here, if you look at this, this is density times acceleration, which is also called mass matrix, which is going to yield the mass matrix. And this part may also be replaced by a finite fold source over an area to make a more realistic earthquake simulations. So what's the advantage of using this weak formulation? You can implicitly account for free surface boundary conditions through these integrals. Fluid-solid coupling terms may be explicitly added. Source term explicitly integrated, as you see. And it's valid for any test vector. Finite difference is a strong method, but spectral elements is a weak method, and it has some advantages. So the message I would like to give you is that there is no method which works for every case. For instance, spectral elements might be a more sophisticated method. However, it cannot beat finite difference in most of the cases, and that's why finite difference is still very popular, because of its ease of implementation and very intuitive theory. But we need spectral element methods for certain cases, such as global wave simulations, because, you are discretizing your model using hexahedral elements. Actually, you can also use tetrahedra. And the basis functions that is used in spectral elements, which are Gauss, Lobato, Legendre quadrature, they have some really nice properties, which makes these mass matrix that I showed you, because when you try to solve this, you will need to take the inverse of this, which is an expansive calculation. And using the properties of Gauss, Lobato, Legendre quadrature, you can have a diagonal mass matrix, then you can speed up simulations a lot. And that's the major reason why we can run these global 3D wave simulations with the spectral elements. And spectral elements is a kind of higher order finite element method, but it has the flexibility of finite elements to mesh your domain, and also has the accuracy of pseudo-spectral methods because of these polynomials. Mesh honors major discontinuities, and it has explicit time marching scheme that you have to be careful against the stability issues, etc. If you would like to know more about it, I'm not going to go into details. Please have a look at these references. And this is a nice simulation.
I was wondering if you could comment why the spectral element method is advantageous. In the sense of, why do you need to use these higher order shape functions as opposed to, say, a linear shape function? And I have a feeling it's to do with you want to do well in terms of matching the wiggliness of waves to not get
actually
the...
Actually, it's because of computational efficiency. It dramatically reduces the computational time.
Yeah, but why not use whatever more lower-order shape functions?
Well, Gauss, Lobato, Legendre, you need certain accuracy. So that's why you need to go to higher-order polynomials. But the advantage of Gauss, Lobato, Legendre polynomials is that it gives you a diagonal mass matrix, and then taking its inverse is much more convenient, and which reduces the computational time dramatically.
And using a larger number of, say, second order form shape functions would not give you that? I mean, where does the edge come in?
It depends on how much accuracy you would like to achieve. You may be able to use lower degree polynomials, I believe. But if you'd like to, I mean, definitely there will be a trade-off with the accuracy and the order of the polynomials you choose.
I studied finite elements, but not special element method. I'm not sure why special element want to use fourth order, but in finite element community, there's a concept called HP adaptivity. H means mesh size, P means polynomial order. So if you lower the mesh size or increase the polynomial order, you will get an accurate solution. It is commonly used for convergence tests. So typically for higher order, you will get more accuracy to approximate a general, very general functions locally.
Well, I mean, that's great. We need this recording.
So, yeah, I think I appreciate that. But going to higher order polynomials only gives you a better method if your solution is actually smooth, right? If you have some funkiness in the solution, then the higher order polynomials might not be the way to go, because you just basically, it's like overfitting something that is not a polynomial. So there is an assumption about the smoothness of the solution. And I would think, and of course, you can go to higher order or smaller mesh size. And clearly there is, you know, convergent proofs. But I'm asking, what part of the equation leads people to make a choice that leads to higher order polynomials rather than using lower order polynomials?
Well, I mean, this is a question for Dmitry Kumatich. I believe he made lots of tests to come up with this choice. But I would like to make a comment on numerical solutions that we never would like to have very sharp boundaries in our background model, for instance. We always need to have a certain degree of smoothness,
sure,
just to avoid some numerical problems.
If you had a lower order method, it would probably be more robust when it comes to the nonsense of the sharpness.
I believe this is one of the best for global simulations, but I don't have any. I don't know the answer. But all I know is that it's related to accuracy of the solution.
Maybe.
And even to capture.
I was wondering specifically whether it has to do with numerical dispersion. So
yeah.
You minimize numerical dispersion by going to a higher order element.
Yeah.
And
seems plausible given the wiggliness of the solution.
Maybe I can.
I feel like I have to make some comments on this. Having worked with SpecFem, you know, I guess the idea is, back in the day, we couldn't put the whole Earth, we couldn't mesh the whole Earth and run simulations that were accurate at reasonable frequencies. So one way around this was to assume that the material properties were smoothly varying, and so that you can make kind of bigger boxes, have fewer of them, and do the spectral solution within them. But then, as you said, you know, this is a type of equation where you can actually get sharp features in the wave field that persist, right? They don't necessarily go away. And so, kind of over time, they've been advising us to use smaller and smaller degrees within the boxes, I think, because you're kind of on the right track there, right? If you have like a, you know, degree 20 element, you might be overfitting a solution, or it might not actually be the best approach. So I think now they advise degree 4 elements, right, or something like that.
Well, this is what is implemented in SpecFem, but I know
yeah.
that some other groups would like
yeah.
to go
so,
higher.
So my the spectral element code I used, which was Jan Kapteveld's, I think was you could do 8th order elements. But then the problem is if your material properties vary sharply within an element, you get like Gibbs phenomena essentially within the elements. So I guess nowadays they could even do linear elements for global wave propagation, but
maybe I can try to tie this together in a way. So in general, in finite element theory, using a higher order finite element will give you a better accuracy for a given computational time that you need to compute these shape functions and the solution. But as you mentioned, it will give you problems if you have sharp features in the domain. And therefore, a given finite element degree is often not the perfect choice for all parts of your domain. And that's where the HP adaptivity comes in that was mentioned before. So ideally, you would want to have a very fine mesh of very low order finite elements or spectral elements close to sharp features and coarser cells with a higher order far away and in regions that are smooth, because there you can save computational time by using a higher order finite element.
Can I continue?
One more thing. So that's awesome. I think, and now I might be wrong, but my understanding is that it's even harder when it comes to solving the wave equation, because whereas you guys know which domains have sharp features because they depend on the local structure or whatever, for us, those sharp features can actually be contained in the wave field itself, and they can kind of sweep across parts of the domain at some times, but then not at other times. So I think it's a little, it's even trickier.
Okay, this is just an illustration of acoustic elastic coupling by Daniel Peter, his coffee cup simulation. So you have liquid coffee inside, which is where you saw the acoustic wave propagation and the elastic wave propagation in the ceramic part. So here is the drop in the liquid, and then you can nicely see how it's coupled with the elastic part. And this is actually what is being done in the coupling of outer core and the mantle in simulations, in 3D global simulations.
So is the wave speed the same in the coffee and the cup?
Yeah, it's homogeneous and acoustic. Hopefully, if you can steer the sugar well enough. But you can also allow lateral variations. This is another simulation, but this is for a finite rupture simulation of the 1964 Alaska earthquake by Carl Tape. I really like this simulation. Okay, here is the earthquake. It's a magnitude 9 earthquake, and you can nicely see the rupture propagation, and you can also see the Doppler effect as the rupture propagates in this direction, where you have larger wavelength on the other side. So this is just an illustration how you can use these numerical simulations. And as I said, you need to be careful how you are discretizing your model. This is just to give you an idea how much time you need to spend to discretize your medium. And this is a personal communication with Emanuele Casarotti, who is an expert in meshing complex structures. So basically, the design of the mesh takes about 15% of human time. And then to mesh your environment properly, it generally takes your 8% of time. And then but this is very cheap in terms of CPU time. And then the solver, when you run the wave propagation through that complex structure, it takes 90% of the CPU time, but then you don't really need to spend so much time as a human. So there's this question.
Can you say a few more words why meshing is so complicated? Is it impossible to automate that process? Is it impossible to just say, okay, I know there's a fault there, and then let some software do the meshing for me?
Yeah. In general, yes, you start with an automated version, but then you need to adjust to be able to maintain the stability, etc. And then you may also make, I mean, it's not just like, okay, this is my very complex model. For instance, if you have such a basin where you have very low wave speeds, and if you would like to, and if you have sharp discontinuities, etc., to be able to honor all the discontinuities properly, you need to spend some time on this.
So you want to align the interfaces with the elements?
Or? Depending on your resolution, actually. This is not what we do now. This is what I'm going to say at scale of globe, because our resolution is much lower. This is mainly for very high resolution regional basin simulations or exploration type of problems. So in the global case, we are still using a mesh designed for PRAM model, where all the first order discontinuities are honored like this. And then there are doublings at certain depths, just because we don't need such a dense mesh all the way down to the Earth, because wave speeds increase by that, taking the advantage. This just reduces the computational time. But we need to be careful with the crust, which I'm going to talk about. And this is another simulation for one of the aftershocks of the Mexico event in February, magnitude 7.2. Basically, what you are looking at, the vertical up and down motion of the velocity at the surface. So these are the body waves. Here you see the surface waves coming. And basically, these simulations are computed for a 3D background model, 3D mantle and crustal model. So you start seeing the distortions on the wavefront due to the 3D crustal effects. So you can get these movies from Princeton Shape Movie website. And you can also get the seismograms for every earthquake from Princeton and also from IRIS. So this just continues like this. And as it reaches to the antipode, you can see the interference of seismic waves. So as I said, we can also record all these simulations at seismic stations. So basically, here you are seeing a comparison of observed and synthetic seismograms. Observed are the black ones, and the red ones are the synthetic ones. Basically, this is for an earthquake, a deep earthquake in Argentina. And these are the epicentral distances, and the traces are aligned on P waves. These are the station codes. And you see very clean, nice seismograms, but this is because it's a deep event. Not all the records look like this. And we also see that our 3D, current 3D global models, it's S362, I need together with CRUST 2.0, is pretty good at explaining these body waves within this period range. Whereas we start seeing some discrepancies, and this is where our work starts, basically. Our goal is to now try to minimize all these discrepancies. And it's not limited only to Earth. We can also run these simulations for other planets. This is a very long period simulation. I run the simulations, and then Daniel just projected nicely. So this is part of InSight mission. So basically, what we did is we took one of the 1D reference models and implemented in SpecFAM. This is one of the Solan-Spons model with 110 kilometer crustal thickness. So this is mantle, this is liquid outer core, and actually in the reference model there is no inner core, but I just put it for numerical stability. So maybe, who knows if there is a solid inner core or not, but within the period range we are interested in that solid inner core has no effect. So then we superimpose a crustal thickness variations for Mars. So basically this is a section across here where we have the thinnest crust. You can see how we honor the crust. This is where the crustal complexities are coming from, and this is where we have largest crustal thickness. And then, so basically, this is how affects these crustal variations together with the topography of Mars. So basically, where we have the thinnest crust, you can see that seismic waves are speeding up just because mantle wave speeds is higher than the crustal wave speeds. And this is just some comparison of 1D versus 3D seismograms with the 3D crustal variations in thickness. So here is an earthquake at the location of the InSight lander. So using reciprocity, I just put the earthquake here and then computed station seismograms at these stations. So you can see the distortions specifically on surface waves as expected due to crust. So now the question is, how can we use these 3D wave simulations to further improve the tomographic images? So in the classical sense, in classical seismic tomography, the goal is starting from a 1D background, radially symmetric background model such as PRAM, to estimate the 3D lateral variations in the mantle, right? Like this. And this procedure is mainly based on ray theory for computational ease. Recently, finite frequency theory based on some 1D background models have been used, and most recently 3D synthetics with asymptotic kernels. And the data to improve the data coverage, some different types of data sets are being used, and it's also common to use crustal corrections, which I'm going to mention a bit more very soon. Now, we are now at a stage in the current resolution of tomographic images. We are at a stage where the details matter. As you see, you will remember from discussions during Maureen's talk, we have so many different mantle models, and they more or less agree with each other at long wavelengths. We have some common features, that's fine, but when we go into details, they significantly differ from each other. So we are now, I think, at a regime that we should try to avoid approximations as much as possible. Okay, one of the things is that finite frequency effects have become important, so this is the classical banana donuts, where the data sensitivities between source and receiver looks like a banana, and if you take a cross-section orthogonal to this, it looks like a donut. So, but to make the entire story complete, these data sensitivities must be computed, both together with the forward simulations. They need to be calculated numerically in a realistic 3D Earth model. And data coverage has been one of the main challenges of global seismic tomography. As you all know, earthquakes generally happen at plate boundaries, always at the same locations. And then this is the distribution of seismic stations. We have generally, well, naturally have more stations in continents and in the northern hemisphere. And nowadays we have really dense networks such as US Array in continents, which are great because that gives us lots of opportunities to improve the resolution underneath these continents, lithospheric structure. However, that also imposes extra challenges in global tomography. So ideally, we should cover all the oceans with OVS stations, like US Array stations everywhere in the oceans. That's the dream of all global seismologists, I believe. So there are some projects like Mermaids, these floating acoustic robots, are also promising to sample data from oceans. So any data from oceans is very invaluable. So in the classical sense, to improve the data coverage, different types of data are being assimilated. So such as body wave travel times, normal modes, minor and major arc surface wave phase and group wave speeds, or waveforms of some specific waves, such as surface waves or SSS waves. We cannot change this source station distribution at the moment, but we can change the amount of information that we get from every seismogram, and this is where the numerical methods are very crucial, because in the classical sense, the amount of data or the information you can put in inverse problem is strictly related to the forward theory you are using. But if you are able to take the full physics into account numerically, then actually you can use any wiggle in these seismograms. In the ideal case, complete seismograms in three components, which dramatically increases the amount of information. Sure.
15 years ago, when we had the first CIDR brainstorming meeting at the Marconi Center, distinguished seismologist now sitting right next to me, and they were, you know, Tony Dallin and Mr. Lay maybe were there arguing for, you know, the greatness of the theory improvements. And he said that actually all you need is more data. Are you saying that now we're at the stage where it'd be okay not to have more data?
No, I would be happy to have more data, especially from oceans. But we also need to take the full physics into account. This is what I mean, because we are now at a stage where all these approximations start becoming visible, right? So we have to use the complete physics, and we need more data, of course. And actually now, what I would like to say is that more or less the forward part has been solved. Now we need to focus on the inverse part, but we need more data, especially at the scale of globe. I want everything. So these 3D wave simulations have been used by WETT, and in a recent publication, French and Romanovich, using what was this? Nonlinear asymptotic coupling theory, right? And kernels. So this is an upper mantle model with radial anisotropy. These are, you know, the famous plumes. And another challenge is, and this is also equally important, crust can be highly nonlinear. And as I said, in the classical tomography, crustal corrections are preferred just because using classical methods or ray theoretical methods, crust is highly heterogeneous and extremely thin that it's not possible to invert in the classical tomography. But crustal effects can be highly nonlinear because crustal thickness variations vary from 7 kilometers, about 7 kilometers underneath the oceans, and can be up to 70 kilometers. So that makes crustal corrections pretty questionable, because we are making basically two big assumptions. The first one is that we assume we can estimate the crustal phase by using first order approximations, which is true, most likely, because it also depends on the period range you're interested in, propagation distance, etc., and the crustal type. And the second, but as you, if you would like to improve the resolution, as you go down to shorter periods, these first order approximations start breaking up. And the second biggest assumption is that we assume we know the crust perfectly well, which is not the case. So all these things together makes crustal corrections questionable. And I'm going to argue that what we see, the discrepancy we see specifically in the upper mantle, both in anisotropy and maybe mainly in anisotropy, might be the imperfect crustal corrections or the crustal phase that is not properly corrected, that is mapped into upper mantle. So, yeah.
So, with this thought, then, what is the, do you know what the effect of using different crustal models are, such as even CREST 5.0, CREST 2.0, CREST 1.0,
Litho 1.0? Yeah. Actually, I have such a slide, but I just put it to the back, considering all these slides that I'm ready to show you. Okay, there are various studies that assess these crustal corrections. This was my PhD thesis, actually. So here, this shows a just the radial anisotropy in upper mantle due to uncorrected crustal signal. But this is just coming from the first order approximations that are being used. It may not be entirely perfect, but just gives us a good warning that look at the percentage in the anisotropy, 6%. And this is just due to crust, uncorrected crustal signal. And Anna Ferreira just took different crustal models, CREST 2.0, 3S MAC, CREST 07, and then made some inversions with these crustal corrections using different crustal models. And then you can see how the structure can change underneath Pacific just based on the choice of your crustal model. And this is the anisotropy, which is more worrying. You see, you don't see these red bulbs at all here, or look at the continents. So there is a good warning that all in all, we may be biasing. And actually, the main reason is that Laurent Rayleigh waves, specifically, at the same period, they sample different depths.
I guess I'd like to comment on that briefly.
Sure.
And I think your point is, of course, very well taken, that the crust leads to possibly very large trade-offs. But when you look at the oceanic plates, for example, generally speaking, the crustal thickness variations are not that large. And yet, the differences in the imaged radially anisotropic structure are quite large, even in the oceanic plates. And so I wonder if you're suggesting that all of those discrepancies are just because of the crustal correction.
No,
if so, I would take issue with that. Because,
not all of them, of
course. For example, in this Savani model, Ludwig Auer did a bunch of different tests where we, there are sensitivities depending on if you're using crust 2.0 or crust 1.0 in places, and we know why that is. But overall, the radial anisotropy seemed quite robust.
No. Just don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that all the anisotropy I've seen is coming from the crust.
No, all the variations between the different models. That's
that might be because of these crust.
I don't think that's true.
Well, I think that's true.
But so what's the difference then between the tests, for example, that Auer and others did?
No, I mean, also I need to make a comment that I'm talking about improving the resolution. At long periods, life is easier, and probably all these approximations are working fine. But when you go down to 40 seconds, it's a mess. And it's mainly because of, I can show you, it's a very simple reason. Look at the sensitivity of Rayleigh and Lau waves at 40 seconds. Lau waves are entirely sampling the crust, but not only the crust, underneath oceans, also the mantle. So when you look at these long paths, all these approximations are likely to break down. But my concern is, if when we are trying to improve the resolution, we need to deal with crust in a proper way.
I have a completely uninteresting but technical point, which is that in my experience, a big reason for discrepancies between different radial anisotropic models, even constructed from an from the same data set, has to do with exactly how you weight the different data sets. So the radial anisotropy comes from the relative difference in the behavior of, I guess, Love waves, or in the constraints from Love waves and Rayleigh waves. For Rayleigh waves, we tend to have much, much more data and usually better coverage as well. And so kind of you can get different models based on how much you upweight that Love data so that it speaks kind of as loudly as the Rayleigh wave data. And that can really matter.
Wow. I agree with you. That might be another source of discrepancy. Yep. Okay. Another thing. I said crust must be treated properly. This is what I believe, and this is what is being done in spectral element code that we are using. So basically, the crustal thickness is honored. MOHO is honored. Here you are looking at a cross-section across Andes. This is the oceanic crust where we are sampling the oceanic crust with one spectral element. But in fact, we are honoring the crust because of computational efficiency. Because if we don't, oceanic crust is too thin that we don't have enough sample which directly biases surface wave speeds. And the underneath continents, continental crust is sampled by two spectral elements, and the transition zones denoted by white areas, we don't strictly honor, but run through the JRL points. And another way of dealing with crust in numerical simulations is homogenization by Jan Kaptevel. This is a very smart idea, actually. So assume that you have such a model, and if you would like to mesh this perfectly, honoring all these discontinuities, that's going to be extremely expensive. So using Bucks-Gilbert smoothing. So Jan is trying to find a homogenized version, a longer wavelength equivalent of this model. And then you need coarser grid. And then when you run simulations, you can get exactly the same simulations. Yeah. if you are going to ask me about the details, frankly, I don't understand the theory very well.
My question was about this homogenization, because if you have like a water layer, it's quite difficult to do the homogenization. I don't know how you do with like tidal layer, like ocean or sea, or something like that.
Well, I know
because
that
because in this stuff he used like a filter, and the filter is a one over mu, like when you have like s velocity, is a square root of mu over rho.
Frankly, I don't know the details, and I'm also not entirely sure how this is used in inversions. So better to ask Jan for the details.
Okay.
This is just an illustration that you can get the same wave simulations of such a complex model with its homogenized version, which dramatically speeds up the simulations.
Okay. Thank you.
And Jan has a recent paper I haven't read to propose how to use this in full waveform inversions. Okay, I'm going to skip these parts. Basically, all I would like to say is that we've just talked about the linearized inversions. So if you have access to the first order derivatives of your Mistfit function with respect to your model parameters, yeah.
I want to go on a little bit back to the discussion of the effect of the cross, but not the cross. What is the effect of the rigid lithospheric mantle and the heterogeneity within the lithospheric mantle?
What is the effect?
The effect of heterogeneity within the lithospheric mantle. Does it matter?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. Any heterogeneities, especially most of the
and
perturbations are coming from crust and lithosphere.
How you deal with that? How you map it?
Yeah, now I'm going to describe. I'm coming there. I'm basically coming there to show you how we are mapping.
Okay.
By using these 3D simulations. So I would like to speed up a bit. Basically, all I would like to say is that if you have access to Hessian, which is the second derivative of your Mistfit function with respect to model parameters, perfectly you can update your, you can perform linearized inversions or even iterative inversions, which are called the Gauss-Newton method, something similar to what you did in your practicals. But what if you don't have access to Hessian? Then you need to use gradient-based approximations, and these are some methods to do this. Here is the method, but I think I'm going to skip this. But then the question is, how do you get the gradient with these numerical methods? So assume you have a Mistfit function, which is the difference between your synthetic and observed displacement. This is the typical waveform difference. And you can use any Mistfit function. I'm just showing this for convenience because it's the easiest one. And this is the gradient of your Mistfit function. This is the perturbations of your synthetic displacement with respect to your model parameters. And if you just expand it to or write it in the Born approximation, it's given like this. So this is your Mistfit, and this is the Born approximation. Don't be scared. What it tells you is that these are the perturbations in density. This is your Green's function, and this is acceleration. This is your elastic tensor, and then spatial derivatives of your Green's function, and then displacement. So if you look at here, this is, well, you generate your synthetic displacement with an earthquake source, for instance, or any source. But you can see that this is the Green's function, and this is kind of another source term that goes into here. And if you just use the reciprocity of the Green's function and then reverse it back in time, then basically you can define a new displacement field, which we call a joint. This is the Green's function, and this is this is your Mistfit, but reversed in time, basically where your Mistfit is like a source term. So what it means? it means that basically this is your gradient, this is the kernel, the data sensitivity with respect to density, and these are density perturbations. So if you look at, you need to compute this kernel, right, data sensitivity. So it tells you that if you can run forward simulations numerically for a source at the location of source, simulations are generated by an earthquake source and recorded by a station. If you use exactly the same model and now just initiate another simulation, but this time at the location of receiver, but now use the source term. Your source term is the misfit function, misfit between your observed and synthetics, which is this. You can basically run it. You just need one extra simulation, and now you can get your kernels. And basically, this is how you compute the gradient. For those who feel much better with the graphics, so this is your regular earth, let's say, earthquake source here, and this is your station. And then this is what you record. I mean, when you run your simulations, you see this is your S wave, and then it's reflected from surface and then recorded at your receiver like this. And now you made your measurements. You compared your data with the synthetics with the observed data and then computed an adjoint source based on your misfit. And now what you need to do is to inject this source, but this time at the location of receiver, and then backpropagate. The Green's function doesn't change. And now look at the interaction between them at every time step. And then if you integrate it over time, you get your gradient. This is in 2D. If you do it in 3D, you just get, for an isolated P wave, you just get these banana donuts at different frequencies. So at the high frequency limit, your banana donuts collapse onto ray path. Okay, and you can do it for any portion of the data you like. You see, this is SCS. These are core phases, PKP diffracted, and this is PKP AB branch. These are surface waves, and this is a nice illustration that you can basically compute these kernels for any portion. And if you would like, for instance, attack to upper mantle discontinuities to update them in the full waveform immersion, this is a work by Maria Coroni. She just finished her PhD. So what Maria did is that she just put some time window, selected these phases, and then computed sensitivity kernels. For instance, I don't know what this phase is, but now when I look at the data sensitivity, I know that it's P diffracted, right? S diffracted, these are S waves. And this is the reflection from 660 discontinuity. But you can see how complex the wave field. It's not just the sensitivity to 660, but there are all these different types of phases which you are going to miss and which you cannot model when you use classical methods, approximations. And then you start seeing, and this is 420, and this is SS, which is very clean. And if you look at this portion, it looks like there is nothing, but when you compute, basically, it's still affected a lot by the upper mantle discontinuities, right? In 1984, these are the first global models from Woodhouse and Jelonski and the Caltech group. And there is this nice paper, science paper, Jelonski and Woodhouse, a few years later. I just would like to mark this date, 1984. Because when the first global models were published in 1984, apparently it was such a productive year. Albert Tarantola, who is an exploration seismologist, he just wrote a paper, published a paper in 1984, basically giving the recipe of these adjoint inversions. And then you see that he describes it. Each step of the iterative algorithm essentially consists of a forward propagation of the actual sources in the current model and forward propagation backward in time of the data residuals. And then 2 years later, they demonstrated it to image this cylindrical body. It's a 2D problem, and then performed five iterations on the supercomputer of that time. It was the Cray system of Total. And then they concluded that the main limitation of numerical methods is their computational cost in both time and memory requirements. 84, the first global models published. 84, Alberto Rantolo gave the recipe. And it took 30 years for us to apply, more than 30 years for us to apply these methods to global inversions. And in 2016, we published the first model. So this is just a comparison, just to give you an idea about the size of the problem we are dealing with. So this was a kind of 1 by 1 kilometer 2D problem. In our case, we are trying to image the entire globe. They had 200 by 200 grid points. In our current resolution, we have more than 300 million grid points, and very soon it will be billions. They used 8 shots and 400 receivers. In the construction of this model, we used 253 earthquakes. Each earthquake had about 1,000 stations. And the goal is to use more than 6,000 events, basically all the events. It was a 2D acoustic problem. This is a 3D anelastic problem. They computed 8-second seismograms. We are currently routinely computing 180-minute seismograms. That's why it took about 30 years. So GLAAD-N15 is the first generation globally joint tomography model. It has transverse isotropy in the upper mantle. P and S wave speed models are being produced. Forward simulations and Fresnel sensitivity kernels are computed in 3D Earth models using spectral element and edge joint methods. We use 253 earthquakes and perform 15 conjugate gradient iterations. And crust and mantle are inverted simultaneously, so in our case, there is no crustal correction. And this is the code we used, Spectrum 3D globe. This was our starting model, S362NE, with crust 2.0, topography, bathymetry, attenuation, elliptic derotation, gravity, ocean load, they are all included. We initially computed 100-minute seismograms, then we increased duration to 180. This was the resolution, the minimum period at the beginning, and now we went down to 17 seconds, and very soon it will be 9 seconds. This is the distribution of earthquakes and stations, and just some sections. This is basically a cross-section at 250 kilometers. This is the starting model. Basically, you are looking at Pacific. Here is New Zealand, North America. And this is how the model changed after 15 iterations. So basically, I just highlighted, without making any speculation, some slab and plume regions. So this is a cross-section across Pacific, from New Zealand towards North America. So this is the starting model. This is how the Pacific superplume region and the Samoa plume is enhanced. Another cross-section across the same region, and this is where we see this kind of interaction between Tonga slab and Tahiti plume, and here is Galapagos. I borrowed this slide from Magali, so basically about the theory of multi-scale plumes. So it was just interesting for me because I took another section from New Zealand towards Samoa, and these are VPVS ratios, and this is Pacific superplume, and somehow in the upper mantle, I observed these upwellings, which coincide with the volcanic islands, and this is the New Zealand geothermal zone. However, you know, that brings us to the uncertainty and resolution quantification. We have to make sure the robustness of these features. Are they the artifacts or, yeah.
Good question. Yeah. On the right, I'm trying to like, because it's 3D visualization, I'm trying to understand. On the right, there's like a slow part, and then it transitions very rapidly to fast. Is there a discontinuity in the parameterization, and what depth is that?
This is 660.
660?
It's not our parameterization. It's our starting model, because S362NE might have this bias in parameterization or... And also, there is a upper mantle topography. There are topographies in the upper mantle discontinuities, but that's coming from the starting model.
Okay, thank you.
Is
sort of along those lines, the starting model is very smooth. And so I wonder, are you going to talk about a comparison of your improved inversion with models that have somewhat higher resolutions, like S40 RTS, for example?
I made a very brief comparison in the paper. I can tell you that in terms of the scale length of heterogeneities, we are not at S40 RTS yet. It has more smaller scale heterogeneities, but that doesn't mean that it's high resolution. But I'm coming now to the next slide, that this is not the end. Actually, Princeton group now performed 9 more iterations. Unfortunately, I won't be able to show those models, but I can show afterwards because it's not published yet. That's why we are asked not to show anything unpublished right now, but I can show after the talk.
I guess I was wondering also, you know, looking at the kernels, do you expect certain regions that are then better resolved, like say closer to the source, so you would expect better slabs because you have all this detail close to the source, whereas where the rays are turning around, you have less of an improvement?
It's something that we are trying to avoid because we are applying some preconditioners to get rid of these high sensitivities around source and receivers. But maybe I can show it here. I applied a kind of multi-scale smoothing, which means that I defined my smoothing operator as a function of data coverage. So, for instance, regions with dense coverage, such as North America, I smoothed less. So I start seeing all these plumes, etc. Even 15 iterations is not a lot for gradient-based optimizations. But wherever I have poor coverage, I just smooth a lot because I don't trust those regions. Okay. So this is a cross-section across North America and a vertical cross-section here. Basically, this is Yellowstone and the other plumes. And here is another section, relatively poorly covered region in the southern hemisphere. This is basically Erebus hotspot. And these are some resolution tests we performed. If you'd like to know more about, just let me know. And this is the misfit reduction. This is the total misfit reduction. And we combine different period bands. Basically, we cannot really use 17 seconds surface waves. But this is the surface wave regime. So the minimum period is 45 seconds at the moment. But we combine those long period surface waves with higher resolution body waves. So this is vertical radial transverse. Basically, you are looking at the misfit reduction at each component. These are mainly dominated by surface waves, Rayleigh and Lau waves. These are the body waves. As I said, this is not the end. Van Gile and Yu-Yi Ruan, they took GLAD N15 and they expanded their data set. Currently, they are using data from more than 1,400 earthquakes. And this shows the distribution of their seismic stations. Basically, they also added OBS stations in the oceans. And they performed 9 more iterations. And I can tell you that there's quite some significant difference, improvement. I mean, they didn't change the overall picture, but for instance, lower mantle perturbations now are nicely 3% very easily. Yeah. If you would like to see the model, I can show you afterwards.
Can I just ask a clarification? Yeah. So as a non-seismologist, it's not intuitive to me what the 17-second significance is. Can you elaborate on that?
Maybe I can elaborate it with this figure. So basically, you are looking at 3 component seismograms for an earthquake in New Zealand recorded at a station in Afghanistan. These are the same seismograms, but bandpass filtered at different period ranges. So vertical, radial, and transverse. So this is the longest period. They are filtered between 92 to 250 seconds. And here, basically, you are seeing Rayleigh waves, and this is the Lau wave, and these are the major arc Rayleigh waves. So I only select Rayleigh waves here because we don't always have these broadband STS-2 stations worldwide, so the quality of body waves might be a bit poor. And this is a shorter period band from 45 to 110 seconds. And here, I select anything I can, both body waves and surface waves from minor and major arc waves, okay? But as you go down to shorter periods, this is from 30 to 56 seconds, you see how the waveforms become so complex, especially in the surface wave regime. It's almost impossible to make a reliable measurement here. So I don't select any surface wave. But we have nice body waves, and we keep the body waves. And when we go down to 17 seconds, actually these body waves become even nicer, sharp and crisp. So this is how we combine. That's the trick. Yeah.
Just as a follow-up to that, I recall like reading or being told that Tarantula wrote a paper saying you should not use the full waveform as a misfit. And it seems like for the global application, you're still isolating parts of the waveform and you're not using the full waveform approach. However, there are regional finite frequency and full waveform approaches where it seems the full waveform fitting actually worked nicely on scales of thousands of kilometers.
Yeah.
Is there some general takeaway? Just the global simulations will eventually use the full waveform, or is there something inherent that says
why we are selecting these windows is closely tied to the misfit function we use at the moment. It's travel time, frequency dependent travel times. That's why to maximize the information to balance these amplitude differences. But the reason why we are still using phases is just to simplify the problem. Currently, we are still only inverting for the elastic model, and amplitudes are also sensitive, or they are. Well, phase information is more linearly related to Earth parameters. That's why we can separate this elastic and inelastic structure. But when we use the amplitudes, definitely it will dramatically improve. But we then have to be careful, and most likely that we have to, and this is what we are currently setting up, we have to invert elastic and inelastic structure simultaneously, and also take care of source effects, because amplitudes are directly affected by the source radiation pattern, etc. But that's the way to go. Yeah.
I saw that you had a delogged VP by VS picture there. So you're modeling VP as well as VS.
Excuse me.
Wasn't that the slab
this
picture?
One? This one. This is VP VS ratio.
Okay. So I have one of those little annoying detail questions.
Yeah.
Do you worry about where the earthquakes are?
Yeah.
All right, so you're relocating the earthquakes.
Yes, we perform source inversions, and currently what we do is at every iteration we perform a grid search just to apply a correction to phase.
So you're doing a centroid type of solution? You're actually moving the earthquakes?
Yes. Okay. Well, at the beginning we did. Currently we are not doing. Currently we are, at every iteration, we are applying this correction to scalar moment and the origin times, performing a grid search. But I definitely worry about the location of sources. And actually, this is one of the places that we need to worry about. And not only the uncertainty in the locations, but also these upwellings might be because there are lots of earthquakes here.
Yeah.
Something like this.
The reason I'm asking is that, you know, it's kind of a secret that you never really see global P-wave models. And the reason is they're not very consistent with each other. And one of the main reasons for that is that they are very sensitive to earthquake locations. The signal from 3D structure is about the same as the signal that we get from just having not knowing where the earthquakes are. Not so bad for S. It's so you can, anybody can make a good S model. But it's harder to make
the P-model. I totally agree with you. And actually, again, we are in the regime where the source uncertainties are comparable to structural uncertainties, probably. So that's a very good question. That's a very good point. And one way is to repeat our source inversions in the updated model. So trying to do back and forth to try to minimize source structure trade-off. And but that's one of the main challenges, actually. And that's going to be emphasized even more when we expand the data set. And this comes also to your question. I already explained there are various misfit functions, waveform difference, travel times, amplitude. So the thing is that when you are using amplitudes, you have to be careful. But even when you are just using phase, this is what Ved showed, that if you define a proper misfit function like instantaneous phase, which is the phase that you measure in Hilbert domain, so as a function of time, don't be confused by the Fourier phase. So it has some nice properties because then it allows you to use longer wave trains without missing any information. And it's still a phase measurement. The advantage is that this is a synthetic test that Ved already showed by Florian. This is the target plume. And this is what you get when you use classical cross-correlation travel times. And this is what you get when you use such a misfit. Just because instantaneous phase is quite sensitive to the coda of the waves, where all this scattering information lies. So there is room for improvement, your measurements, and ultimately the resolution. This is another demonstration, double difference misfit by Yan Hua Yuan. So basically, this is already a known misfit in earthquake problems. Basically, what we are doing is looking at the misfit between observed and synthetic at a single location. But instead, she's looking at the cross correlations of observed data with the nearby stations and the synthetic data and looking at their differences. So the result is this is a 2D experiment. It's a target phase lost map. This is what she gets with classical cross correlation, and this is what she gets with the double difference cross correlation. Dramatically improves the resolution. If we have time, I don't know. This is, okay, what we are doing. But what is the cost of performing such inversions? So to compute, of course, these numbers are a bit old. And it's based on Oak Ridge National Labs supercomputer, the current Titan supercomputer. So it may be different, but just to give you a comparison. This is if you use the CPU version of the code and to compute 180-minute seismograms with a resolution down to 27 seconds. For one event, this is the CPU hour you need, more than 5,000. And if you have 255 events to perform one iteration, you need about 1.5 million. And if you would like to perform 20 iterations, you need 28 million core hours. And if you increase the resolution down to 17 seconds, you need about 86 million core hours. So how can we overcome this? There are some ways. So code or method development optimization and the current future computational resources might be some remedies. So then Daniel Peter rewrote the SPECFAM 3D globe package using these graphics cards. This is the GPU version. Don't be mistaken, this is also running. This is the CPU version. So you can see the speed difference. So the takeaway message is that, of course, this may not be a fair comparison because GPUs are more expensive than CPUs. But if you have the same number of graphics cards as CPUs, this is going to be the speed you get. And so then with the GPU version of the code, with this resolution, we just need about more than, slightly more than 3 million core hours. So you can see the dramatic improvement. But then you need a big computer. So now we are running our simulations on Oak Ridge National Labs Titan system, which has more than 16,000 graphics cards. So this is basically how these global inversions, a joint tomography, has become feasible. And now we are getting ready to run our iterations on their next generation supercomputer. I think this is currently the fastest supercomputer. And our goal is to go down to 9 seconds. And ultimately, we would like to go down to 1 hertz. globally, but that's going to be the exascale computing.
Can I ask a quick question about this comparison?
Yeah.
So you showed CPU versus GPU. Is that one CPU as in one processor or one CPU as in one core?
Because
you have the full processor, like 12 cores or 24 cores or something? The exact number is not important, but like I was just wondering, because the difference in runtime is about a factor of 10.
Yeah.
But one GPU takes about as much space and energy as like 12 CPU cores or something.
Yeah, like a whole processor. Of course, you can also run multiple simulations in one GPU, even one graphics card. But this is these tests are done exactly one node versus one processor, something like that.
I was wondering how SpecFEM treats the ocean, because presumably that's important at 1 second or even 9 seconds.
Yeah.
And the oceanic sediments where the velocities might be a couple hundred meters per second.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only the oceanic sediments, but the ocean itself will have a huge impact on this short period by the waves when we go down to 1 hertz. Currently, we are not simulating waves in the ocean layer because it's too expensive, because wave speeds are too slow. But when we go down to 1 hertz, this is something that we need to tackle with. All I know is that Dimitri has an idea how to deal with it, but it's not implemented yet. Yeah. Can you pass?
I have a comment on that, because actually, in the SEM, they use like the pressure. They replace the ocean by the pressure of the water.
We are taking into account the ocean load, but we are not running simulations in the global code. It's the load. We just take the effect of ocean layer, the weight of ocean layer on seismic waves currently, but we are not explicitly running simulations in the ocean layer, because that dramatically makes our simulations way more expensive. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, I have a follow-up question.
To what frequency is treating the ocean as a load rather than actually solving the wave equation in it? When is it valid? I thought it was like 10-second-ish.
Good question. Probably around 10-9 seconds we should start worrying about.
Yeah.
Maybe less. Maybe we should do some tests. It's
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I can't remember. I feel like I read that somewhere, but
it's time to revise the oceans as well. Yeah, that's another complexity. Yeah. Okay. So this is what we are doing, but this figure illustrates kind of kernel coverage that I had during the construction of GLAD N15. This is the diagonal terms of Hessian, which acts like the kernel coverage. So basically, you are looking at from North Pole here and from South Pole here. So as you see, naturally, as you would expect, we have the densest coverage in the crust and upper mantle, especially underneath Pacific. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have all the nice cross paths, but and the African side is slightly worse, but as we go down to core mantle boundary, the coverage gets worse, and the worst case is the core mantle boundary underneath South Pole. So how can we improve this? Of course, we need more stations, but until we have OBS arrays in the oceans. So this is why we'd like to go down to shorter periods to take the advantage of these high frequency body waves, which nicely sample lower mantle. Ultimate goal is to use all these more than 6,000 earthquakes since 1999 within the magnitude range we are interested in. But of course, this is also going to introduce some This already introduces quite some computational problems. This is a typical joint tomography workflow, which has, these are a bit technical parts, but I think if you would like to carry out such a research, these are the challenges that you are going to face with on these supercomputers. So the workflow has basically three parts, the numerical simulations, data processing part, and the post-processing part. And the bottlenecks is that all seismologists are familiar with SAC, the data format we are using, where we have one file per time series. Like, assume that you have a three-component seismogram, that means you have three files, observed and synthetic, in total six files. Assume that you have 1,000 stations, then you have 6,000 files. Multiply it by 255 earthquakes. And you would like to do it, you would like to reprocess them. And when you submit these, very easily you can have millions of files being processed at the same time. And when we first had access to these Oak Ridge National Labs cluster, supercomputer, we went there and explained our workflow, and they were terrified. They were like, you cannot do it here. You cannot generate and create such a huge I/O problem on these supercomputers. And not only the seismograms, but also the files of SPECFAM, they can be easily thousands. So that's why we had to change the data format, both the for the seismograms and the computational data. So the ASDF is designed for this. ASDF means adaptive seismic data format. Basically, what it does is that you can now store all these seismograms per event in a single file with the appropriate header information. SAC is a bit restrictive. You cannot really add all the header information you like, but now with ASDF, it's HDF5. It uses HDF5 libraries. It's pretty flexible. You can store any information you like about your simulations, processing, etc. And that means instead of having thousands of files, you have only two files per earthquake. And then we implemented IDOs for the SPECFAM meshes, kernels, models, etc. So this is the new workflow, but now the next step is to make this entire workflow, because this is iterative, at least to make one iteration as automated as possible to also reduce the human error. But of course, I still don't like the exploration idea. I like to check the models after every iteration. In exploration, they just start iterations and then just look at the results after maybe 200 iterations. At the scale of globe, we are still demonstrating. So this is a summary. I'm not going to go into this, and I will just stop here with this movie by David Pugmire, who is a visualization scientist at Oak Ridge National Lab, who just plotted these negative perturbations, basically the denoting plume structures of GLAD M15. So enjoy the performance.
Maybe are there any burning questions? Or I'm getting a sense of eagerness to go to lunch. Burning questions you want to ask, or maybe get answers over coffee break?
Yeah. There is one question, I think. Where is the mic? There is one question.
You need to raise your hands.
Sorry. So in seismic tomography, are you assuming the density is already ruined?
Currently, well, it's a very difficult problem to invert for density. Currently, we are scaling density from shear waves.
Yeah.
This is how we treat density.
Yeah. I mean, is it possible to invert density and velocity simultaneously?
Well, in theory, it's possible, but there's a huge trade-off between parameters. And actually, that's the next step. What I said previously, that forward part of the problem is done. Now, how are we going to take care of the physics of the problem in the inverse problem? Definitely, it's worthwhile to look at, and there are some studies to investigate, but most of the density information is very weak, and in the amplitudes, within the period range we are working on,
Yes, but
unlike normal modes, we cannot very robust. It's a difficult problem.
Okay, I think that's great.